welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a markets reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor at Bloomberg. Sarah, I'm excited. Did you know we have a new Twitter handle for all of the podcasts on Bloomberg?
I do, and it's pretty amazing because you might guess exactly what that handle is.
At Podcasts. Pretty easy to remember.
Can't forget it. So go give podcasts a follow. You'll see everything related to What Goes Up and all of Bloomberg's other podcasts out there as well. Well, this week, What Goes Up will be focusing on what goes down. We'll interview one of the most successful short sellers in the business about how he finds opportunities to bet against stocks in the middle of the bull market that we're currently in. And we'll also dive into what markets are expecting ahead of next week's big Fed meeting.
And Sarah, I'm excited about something else, too. Obviously, we do our weekly end of show tradition, which is the craziest thing we saw in markets this week. Our first guest, I told him about this thing we do, and he said, I've got about a dozen crazy things I could talk about.
All right. So, well, I'm ready to hear at least five of them.
We'll see how much time we have. But before I introduce him, I want to basically explain what he does. Now, he's an activist short seller. And the reason why I want to explain it, I know there's a lot of sophisticated listeners out there who know exactly what that is. But there's some unsophisticated listeners. And I know that because I've basically been grabbing every phone I can see and subscribing them to the podcast. You know, friends, I'm like, you're a kindergarten teacher? Have I got the podcast
That's for kosher.
You?
It's right. Kosher.
It's totally fine. It counts. So an activist short seller. Now, a short seller is someone who bets that stocks are going to go down, the opposite of your traditional long investor. And the way they do that is they'll go to their broker and say, I'd like to borrow 1,000 shares of this company. And say the company's selling at $100 a share. The short seller then sells those borrowed shares and pockets $100,000 for selling them. And then what they're hoping is that stock price goes down. And if they're an activist short, they'll go and release some research explaining why they think the stock's going to go down. They might go on a podcast, for example, go on TV and talk it up. And with any luck, say the stock goes from $100 to $50. Well, the short then repays that loan. Remember, that loan was in borrowed stock, not borrowed dollars. So they now just buy 1,000 shares for $50 a share. And they pocket that $50,000 in between, minus the fees to the broker. So we're lucky today to have one of the most skilled short sellers out there. His fund, Spruce Point Capital Management, their activism fund, according to Barclay Hedge, a database that tracks these things, returned 24% last year, the best market neutral equity fund performance of last year. So Ben Axler of Spruce Point Capital, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mike, thanks for having me.
Did I botch the explanation of activism shorts selling there?
You forgot that in addition to repaying fees to the broker, there's dividends paid as well. So you got to factor in all those costs.
Right. Okay.
You got to pay the dividends. Get it all in there.
Also joining the show this week is Sebastian Boyd, who covers LATAM markets and global credit markets for the Bloomberg Markets Live blog. Sarah, little known piece of trivia about Sebastian Boyd. He actually started the whole global financial crisis in 2008. Did you know that?
I had no idea, but I can't wait to hear the story behind this.
He'll explain it all at the end. Let him wait, Seb.
A good tease.
But Seb's in town. He's based in Santiago, Chile. But he's in town to attend a high-yield investment conference. Is that right, Seb?
That's right. So I've spent yesterday and Tuesday listening to high-yield and leveraged loan investors bemoaning their fate.
So I guess we'll hear about what they were saying, bemoaning their fate, later on in the show.
We'll get into all that. Ben, let's start with you, though. You know, like I said, 24% return, according to Barclay Hedge, the top market neutral equity fund last year. This is a time when the bull market is raging on. In the media, in the financial media, we read all these horror stories about short sellers. You know, David Einhorn trying to short the bubble basket, he called it, and Bill Ackman with his struggles with Herbalife. What are you doing right that these guys are doing wrong?
Well, thank you. It's an honor just to be named in the same breath of these other successful fund managers. But what we try to do is find companies where we can really have an edge, right? You mentioned Herbalife, Tesla. These are multi-billion dollar companies. Where we've had a lot of success, I think, is in some of the smaller to mid-cap names. You know, these are names billion, 2 billion, all the way up to 6 billion that are less trafficked. They have a lower short interest. They don't have a well-understood bear case. they might have a structural flaw or an accounting problem that is, you know, accelerating results, which is, you know, providing a short-term boost to their share price. So we're trying to look, and the names are less trafficked. You know, maybe there's fewer sell-side analysts that are covering it. Maybe there's a higher retail base that's in the name that might not understand what's going on. So it's by looking where other people aren't looking, I think, is where we're getting a slightly differentiated edge.
I know over the past couple of years, many of people have looked at the gains we've seen in equities and said equities is really the place to be. You want to be positioned in risk. But you've also called the environment we've been in a golden era for short selling. Why is that? How is it possible that some people are so gung-ho going long the stock market, but yet you're finding so many opportunities to short?
It comes down to valuation, right? I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you have to understand the price you're paying for the security you own. And our view is that the market has been rich. Why is it rich? I mean, interest rates have been suppressed artificially low for a long time. That's invited a lot of easy money looking for returns. And equities have, you know, outperformed as an asset class. But in certain cases, there's been pockets of bubbles, right? We've seen, you know, new industries like, you know, Bitcoin come up, marijuana stocks. These are sort of classic examples of too much money chasing, you know, too few returns. Now, I think the other aspect is the regulatory environment. We're in a very low regulatory regime under, you know, Donald Trump, who's cutting budgets to the EPA. The SEC has brought the fewest case enforcement cases this year, you know, than any other year in prior years. So it's a combination of these factors that's creating an environment where, you know, share prices are excessive, where short sellers can come in. Mike, to your point, you know, why do we do activism? We do it because we can clearly communicate a differentiated, you know, viewpoint to explain why we think, you know, these securities are overvalued. And that's how sort of we go about it.
I also wonder, you know, so much of the brain power on Wall Street in recent years has been focused on sort of how to be the best possible passive investor you can be, you know, whether it's factor investing, the whole advance of the quant funds and really, you know, looking at the market more from a 30,000 foot level than actually getting in the weeds and digging through individual companies' filings. I mean, is that part of it? You think has this sort of art of sort of bottoms up research? It's obviously not a lost art, but it's certainly not what it used to be.
I think you raise a great point. I mean, computers are smart for many things. I mean, they can trade a stock infinitely faster than I can with, you know, my keystrokes. They can, you know, look at numbers, crunch numbers. But what I think is lost is the art of judgment and looking at a holistic picture of a company, not just the financial statements, but the proxy statement to see, you know, how governance changes are being made that might, you know, give management a greater, you know, incentive over shareholders, or subtle changes in language or tone used by management on conference calls. You know, other ways which management can obfuscate, you know, information from the public by redacting information at the SEC. And that, you know, we've had success, for example, doing FOIAs, Freedom of Information Requests, getting that information that computers, you know, will never be able, you know, to get by writing letters to regulators. So The move to the passive environment has made it difficult for short sellers in some regard, but, you know, good old-fashioned homework, looking at the holistic picture, getting various data points, bringing together, synthesizing a thesis, and then putting into action in a, you know, in a short report, I think, you know, is what has given us alpha and an edge.
Ben, I want to come back to what you said about an era of easy money and also low regulation and bring Sebastian in here, because a lot of what's happened over the past 2 weeks have kind of come in the face of that. People talking about the Fed, well, now cutting interest rates would be even more easy money. But also on the regulation side, you have a lot of people talking about big tech now, and you have potential antitrust probes going into play. I want to turn to the Fed, though, and get your view, Sebastian, as we head into the Fed meeting next week. A lot of people are paying attention. How high are the stakes for the Fed to really queue up that they might actually be cutting rates to appease markets at this juncture?
I think the stakes couldn't be any higher. The Fed has had a couple of missteps with its communication recently. In December, we all thought they were going to hike. And then in January, we all thought they were going to cut. They really need to thread the needle, as it were, with their communications between now and the end of the year. It's not something they found very easy, but a misstep by the Fed at this juncture could be really pretty disastrous for all sorts of asset classes.
And especially since you focus on the credit market, Seb, are they sort of as gung-ho pricing in a rate cut as the short-term interest rates market and arguably the stock market?
maybe not quite as gung-ho as the short-term interest rates market, which is looking for rather more cuts. In fact, they're starting now to think about when the hikes are going to come. They're so confident they've already started pricing in the end of the easing cycle. But no, certainly if there were not to be two cuts this year, I think credit markets would feel a lot of pain. That's very much in the assumption.
Ben, for you, if the Fed were to cut, we all know the Fed does not want to help create asset bubbles. They do not want to fuel excesses. But in your mind, if we were to see the Fed cut, does this just really embolden your case for this golden era of short selling because it's just even more easy money for longer?
Precisely. I think the key word is moral hazard. Like, you know, the fact that the Fed is considering cutting rates, I just think is, I don't know the word for it, but it blows my mind, to be blunt with you, that the market is so addicted to easy money that that's the only thing that will keep it up. I mean, we're now 9 or 10 years into a corrective cycle. I mean, these companies have very good balance sheets. You know, there's growth, albeit, you know, low growth. There's been underinvestment in CapEx. A lot of the money's been going to buybacks, which has also been, you know, propping up share prices. This is not what we need. We need internal investment. We need smart M&A. We need to, you know, funnel money into industries that are creating productive value, like technology. I agree is a bright spot in the economy, but low rates would just exacerbate the moral hazard and would embolden us to continue to look for more shorts.
But in the near term, say they do hint next week that a rate cut's coming. I mean, you know, the assumption is you'll just see a rally in everything. Is it tempting for someone like you to sort of flatten out your positions ahead of that, or you just understand that it'll be a short-term effect and you can ride it out even if the stocks you're shorting are rallying?
Yeah, I mean, look, we do trade around our positions a little bit to tweak, you know, short-term view and the Fed or what other economic data is out there. But, I mean, we're really focused on fundamentally flawed companies. We're trying to find fraudulent companies. We're trying to find companies that have a fundamental crack in their business. If the Fed cut rates suddenly or gave a stronger tone, yeah, the share prices might rally in the short term, but that's probably an opportunity for us to add to our short.
Right, right. I should point out, I'm kind of talking my book here personally because I profiled Ben in the latest Bloomberg's Markets magazine. So if you're listening out there, pick it up.
I would also say it's a good read.
Oh.
So he's not talking his own book.
I'm blushing.
But Ben, I also want to talk about some of the FANG stocks because I know these are obviously a lot larger companies. These are, I would imagine, not names that you would go out there and short. But if you talk about this low regulation environment being a place that actually fuels excesses, I'm curious from a contrarian standpoint, is it possible that say you have these very, very large big tech companies, you continue to see valuations rise? Is it potentially possible that if we see a little bit of regulation, it could be good?
Look, I think yes. I mean, I think I'm a proponent of a certain amount of regulation in various industries. I mean, I've seen what industries that have very little regulation can happen. We've seen, you know, Bitcoin, for example, a new nascent industry where no regulation invites a lot of fraud. So a certain amount of regulation is certainly good. You know, some of the tech companies clearly have gotten very big, very powerful. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's remarkable what some of them are doing, you know, with data and AI, for example, on Facebook, how you can upload a photo and they recognize you.
Everyone.
You and your friends.
It's a little scary.
And then, you know, you go to Google and you search for a watch, and then you go on Facebook and you see watch ads. I mean, it's like Big Brother. So I do think there needs to be some regulation, and that'd be probably a good thing for the long run.
What I think is amazing is if you go back to the sort of the start of your hedge fund and your career as a short, some of the first targets were these Chinese companies that listed in the U.S. And there were so many of them that listed here that were just such blatant frauds. You know, it wasn't quite the regulation that sorted that out. It was the market itself. I mean, are those opportunities gone? Has the market sort of self-policed them out of existence, or are there still some to be had?
Oh, there's plenty to be had. Yeah, I think, I mean, if you're talking about the Chinese stocks specifically, I think it's sort of like a cat and a mouse. The early ones that were fraudulent were easier to spot, but you know the mouse has adapted and gotten smarter, and so the second and third generation of Chinese companies that are coming public today, they know the methods that we use to find, you know, the crookedness in some of the companies, so they've adapted and gotten a little smarter. But having said that, there's clearly some opportunities out there. But no, I think the SEC has definitely been, you know, burdened with a lot of inquiries, probably under-resourced to find and police, you know, all the the financial scams and schemes that are out there. And so that's part of, you know, our role as an activist short seller to kind of fill that void in a sense, by, you know, exposing what we think are the bad companies and the bad actors.
Seb, I'm curious, you know, obviously in the U.S., an activist short like Ben can go out there and make his case. I don't think that works in every market around the world. Have you have you run into any sort of activist shorts in the LATAM markets, or is it is that a risky place to be a short?
It would work, certainly. In fact, some of the markets are crying out for an activist short. No, we do have a few activist investors. In Brazil, there's one very high-profile guy called Nelson Tanure, who's a very activist investor, but not in the same model at all. A lot of Latin American companies tend to be family-owned. They're controlled by one big shareholder normally. They don't have a very large free float. Yeah. So it's a dissimilar structure to the U.S. market, where most companies are actually owned by their shareholders. And in Latin America, they're generally, you know, there's one guy.
Yeah. Ben, it must be tough to short a company that's got a huge majority owner like that, or no?
Yes and no. I mean, one of our best successes in the past 12 months has been a company called Weiss Markets. Mm-hmm. Mike, you might be familiar from, you know, growing up in this area. They have supermarkets in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Virginia, New York. We think they're structurally at a disadvantage in those markets. Obviously, the supermarket space is very competitive. It's 25% plus owned by the Weiss family. Mr. Weiss is the chairman. He's the CEO. We did an activist campaign. We did a survey of the products at a supermarket. It's 20% higher than Walmart, than Trader Joe's. How can this persist? So we put it on our website, and quite honestly, I was expecting some response from Weiss, but they were quite quiet.
I was going to say, I'm sure they're not very fond of you.
But they did listen. They cut their prices on 1,000 products.
Wow.
Yeah, so they listened. Clearly, they were listening, but they didn't retaliate by boosting their dividend or doing a share buyback. The CEO didn't even buy back stock, even after his share price fell 15 or 20% after our report. So, no, it can be done, but it has to be done, I think, with the right company and the right setup.
Then that's almost the type of thing an activist long would do, you know, influence the management to lower prices.
Well, I mean, look, you have to be competitive, right? Mm-hmm. And we felt that they were over-earning for a period, but now they can over-earn when consumers can now shop and get, you know, products delivered through Blue Apron or through, you know, Amazon home delivery. Yeah. So I think they finally reached their point where they had to do something to remain competitive.
Seb, while you're here, we have to get your insight, though, moving over on the credit markets. You're here for a conference, so why don't you walk us through? I mean, what's the tone like there, and what were the main highlights?
Well, it's funny that we were talking about the lack of regulation, because the some of the corners of the credit market are very unregulated, particularly the leveraged loan market. There's not a great deal of oversight. They tend to be private contracts between, you know, a lender and a borrower. And there have been all sorts of shenanigans there. And that's the big theme of this conference this week was concern from investors about the tricks that are being played on them.
And this is when we hear the term covenant war, basically what's going on.
It's the covenant war, exactly.
Right.
And it struck me, it was a big topic. It's been a big topic for the last few years. And I was slightly surprised at the level of concern. It's the big issue that they are worried about is the erosion of covenants. And not just it's one thing for the covenants to be weak and everyone knows they're weak and you get paid a bit extra. The problem is that the covenants are often slightly deceptive. You know, the highly paid lawyers who go around and delete commas and remove words, and suddenly the covenant doesn't mean what you thought it meant, and most investors are not lawyers. It's an issue for them.
You know, I'm curious how much you think about the macro as you're picking stocks. I mean, do you have a take on sort of the overall market? I know you've found pockets of valuations that are kind of ridiculous, but are you shorting the S&P as a whole these days?
No, we use it as a hedge for some of our shorts to remove some market beta. But look, you know, about a year ago, you had quoted my comment about we're in the golden era of short selling. I mean, ever since then, the market's been flat, right? I mean, over the past 12 months, I mean, we expect the market to continue to be somewhat, you know, range bound. You know, the companies we're looking at are generally not hitting their targets. I mean, we do talk to companies, you know, and I know CEOs in different industries across, the country, I mean, everyone's telling me, you know, growth is slowing. So I don't expect, you know, even if the Fed cuts rates, it might give it a short-term boost, but I don't see that as a cause for the market to break out to new highs here. In terms of, you know, a macro view, industry-wise, I mean, with our short selling, we do look for industries that are slightly under pressure. As I mentioned, the supermarket industry, it's easier to short a company in an industry going through disruption or structurally declining revenues than it is, like, you know, shorting the FANG stocks, which are, you know, are growing. And it's just
difficult.
It's a debate whether are they growing 15% or 12%, and right. Do growth investors really care? So finding industries going through cyclical disruption or just change is a lot easier from a macro perspective, Mike.
Yeah. And oftentimes it seems like in your work, you'll find a company that people are convinced they have a unique product that's really about to be commoditized or taken over by a competitor. That seems to be a pretty common theme. Is that
right? Yeah, no, we've had a lot of success with what I'd call one-trick ponies. You know, this is a company, I think, you know, in your article, we talked about Caesarstone. It's like they make quartz countertops. They were an early mover in that market, but a countertop is, let's face it, it's a commodity, right? Different, you know, styles and shades. But over time, you know, as competition comes in, margins get competed and profits go away and share price declines. So we do look for, you know, companies where we can understand clearly what the product is, if that product's going through a cycle and when it's going to be, you know, disrupted.
All right, before we get to the craziest thing I ever saw in markets this week, I've got to hear this story, Seb. How did you potentially or actually cause the financial crisis?
Seb started, I'm going to go out and say it, Seb started the financial crisis.
I'm calling bluff.
Don't at me, at Seb on Twitter about this.
Well, first off, I should say it wasn't on purpose.
He's very sorry.
I'm very sorry. I won't do it again. Back in 2007, I was the investment banking reporter for Bloomberg in London. And the subprime crisis had been going on in the US, and Bear had already got into trouble with some of its hedge funds for investing in CDOs. So the topic was very much in the news, but I came in one morning and there was a press release from BNP Paribas, which was a bank that I covered, that they had to freeze prices on some of their funds because they weren't able to value the assets in the funds. They couldn't find anyone who wanted to make a price on these asset-backed securities in their funds. And that meant that they weren't able to value the funds, so they were going to stop. They were going to freeze the funds. Mm-hmm. And that created total panic. It was the first time that the crisis spread out beyond the US, and it was the first time that regulators and people in the banking markets realized that this is going to be a very serious problem. The market had literally just stopped. You couldn't value these things. And unfortunately, what a lot of banks were doing back then was using these asset-backed products to finance themselves. So what particularly the investment banking model, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Lehman Brothers, they were financing themselves in short-term markets and using a lot of asset-backed collateral to do that. And if you can't, you know, no one wants to buy the collateral if the collateral's useless, then it created a huge funding problem for the banks.
So, but that was really the first time on the record someone was saying, we simply can't value these things.
Exactly.
We don't know the price of them. And then that is just a first domino in a row.
It's the most read story I've ever written. And,
do you remember the exact amount?
It was 72,000 readers.
Oh, wow. You still remember?
I do still remember. It's by far the biggest story I've ever written. And then later that morning when the Euribor fixing came in, Euribor spiked.
Wow.
And that was, from then on, it was a year of craziness.
From a year of craziness to a week of craziness.
I know. That's the craziest thing Seb's done in a decade. But for the week, Sarah, have you witnessed any crazy things this week?
So something that I did think was a bit crazy was, if you look at HYG, which is a popular high yield ETF, in the beginning of the month, short interest as a percent of shares outstanding, this is according to market data, was at 37%. Now, that's the highest ever. The fund was created in 2007. So people getting really serious about getting bearish on HYG. Well, clearly those bets didn't pay off. These are very much used for short-term trading. And because of that, after the record shorts, we saw record inflows ever for the fund as well, just because there was so much demand of a potential short squeeze that we started to see creations in the ETF, and it went from record shorts to record inflows within a day. So pretty crazy.
Don't say the word short squeeze. Ben's sweating from his brow right now.
He looks pretty composed.
But Ben, probably you don't ever go short something that's 37-40% short interest already, I would imagine.
Only on a short-term basis if I have a hard catalyst. Yeah, staying short those names a long time is a challenge.
It's tough, yeah. Right. How about you, Ben? Have you seen any crazy market events this week?
Yeah. So, I mean, we started off the week with the big M&A headline, United Technologies and Raytheon. I've been following the aerospace and defense industry for a long time. To me, it sort of marks possibly a peak in that industry. Why? I mean, it was a stock for stock deal. Nobody was ponying up any cash. Mm-hmm. You know, if you read between the lines, to me, it seemed more motivated by optimizing cost structures, which is generally a bad thing for suppliers in the aerospace and defense chain. So the craziest thing that happened out of this, I've had some success in the past shorting, you know, M&A rumors and headlines. There was a headline out by C.L. King, a regional broker you've probably never heard of, saying that Aerojet Rocketdyne is a takeover target. The stock's trading about 40, but now, given that Raytheon was as big its customer was subsumed, now it's worth $60 in a takeout scenario.
Wow.
I've been following this company for a while. It used to be GenCorp. This was a real dog of a stock at $3. Now it's at 40. It's been riding the wave in the sector, but now some broker thinks it's worth 60 because its customer just got taken out. So that was a head scratcher. And then on Wednesday, another dog of the aerospace industry I followed for a while called Kratos was a $2 stock a number of years ago. Now it's at 20. Now there are headlines that it, too, might be a takeover target.
Oh,
so, you know,
boy.
M&A in an industry stokes a lot of irrational optimism that even some of the lower quality stocks in an industry are now takeover targets. So investors be cautioned.
Interesting.
That reminds me of when I started here in Bloomberg in 2007 doing that main stock market story every day. I don't know. Every day it was like I could make a template and just hit, you know, stocks rose on takeover speculation in every industry. So, that's very reminiscent. Seb, have you witnessed any crazy things this week?
Well, I'm not sure you'd call it crazy, but as an example of where the markets are right now, on Thursday, we had Iceland, Ukraine and Peru all borrowing. Peru's a pretty solid emerging market sovereign, but it was borrowing at 95 basis points over treasuries. So you've got a Latin American country paying just over 3% to borrow. That's
wow.
A really good example of why investors are so desperate for yields and why there's so much appetite for some of these riskier products. And Iceland, of course, one of the big victims of the financial crisis, and Ukraine, which defaulted a couple of years ago, is one of the biggest recent sovereign defaults. It's got a conflict in the eastern part of the country. Fairly regular. Well, they've had two revolutions in the last couple of decades and borrowing at under 7%.
Under 7%.
So, reaching for yield.
Is that the lowest spread they've had in a while?
I would say, yeah, that would be the lowest spread they've had ever.
Well, ironically, my crazy thing is Ukraine-based too. Have you guys been watching the Chernobyl series at all on HBO?
Mm-hmm. No, I'm guessing. We all are looking at each other, guessing.
I've
someone's
seen one
gotta
documentary.
Say yes,
but
you've heard about this.
I've heard of it,
thing,
yes.
Right? So there's a lot of buzz about it. It's got people worried about nuclear energy all of a sudden again. And it reminded me of one of the craziest things on the Bloomberg terminal, really in markets anywhere, is you can trade futures contracts of yellow cake, of uranium. It's traded on the NYMEX. Ben, I don't know if you'd ever want to take delivery of one of those futures. call your broker and warn them to...
that one has a high cost to carry.
Yeah, exactly. So I was wondering, well, what's happened to uranium prices during this Chernobyl frenzy? You know, you think people are getting worried about nuclear energy. Maybe uranium prices are getting affected. Nah, they're up 3%. So,
wow.
So uranium, it had a pretty nasty fall, though, about 18%. So I'm gonna try to take some delivery of uranium. You have to buy
good luck with that.
250 pound lots.
Really, so. Yeah, the cost of storing is going to be probably 10 times higher than the actual commodity itself. You know? You're going to have to buy the gear.
But with that said, Ben Axler, Sebastian Boyd, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek. Mike is at Reganonymous. Our guest, Ben Axler, is at Spruce Point Cap. And Sebastian Boyd is at S-E-B-A Boyd. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.